it works really well, Elizabeth.
Great.
So look, it's 10:02. I'm happy to get us started. What do you think? Shall we get started? Hello?
I'm still here. I think.
I want to make sure Elizabeth is getting.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, I hear you, but it sounds like you're on a speakerphone or something, and you might be in a swimming pool. I actually hear music in the background, too.
Could you hear that before?
No. I actually hear music in the background. It sounds like you're playing some reggae or something.
I'm not. I'm on the road, so I'm stuck sitting, like, in a crazy spot. And, okay, so let me try my phone again and see if that works better.
Oh, that's great. I gotta love it, though.
Gotta make it work.
Are you, like, at a truck stop or what? Where are you?
I'm at a Starbucks. Can you hear the coffee grinder going now?
Oh, yeah. I love it. I do me a favor. Get me a double espresso with one Splenda.
Hey, Ed, remember that all adds up.
I know. That is pretty funny. Pretty funny. So look, you tell me when you're ready to get started, and I'll get us started. Uh-oh, now we've lost her again. Hello? I hear. Okay, Elizabeth, tell me when you're ready.
Okay, is this better? Can you still hear the music really loud?
No, it sounds much better.
Okay.
All right? Good. Then I'm going to get us started, okay?
Okay, great. Thank you.
Here goes.
The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Okay, folks, welcome to the fourth in our series of four ACID webinars. And today's presentation will be done mainly by Elizabeth Jennings, who, as you know, is staff member at the Burton Blatt Institute of the University of Syracuse. I've got to tell you that it's sort of been an exciting time here to get us all started, because Elizabeth is at a Starbucks, and she's on the road. She is a road warrior. And so every once in a while, you guys may actually hear something like a coffee grinder going, or someone asking for a mochaccino on ice. And that's because that's where Elizabeth is. But she's ready to get going, so I'm not going to keep her waiting for very long. I do want to do a couple of thank yous, however. First, I want to thank Michelle, who did webinars 2 and 3 and has gotten wonderful evaluations. People really appreciated what she was talking about, geared more to our consumers as opposed to the folks that help the consumers and serve the consumers. Did a great job, so I wanted to thank her for her work on these webinars. Secondly, I want to thank, of course, Jeff Tronson, my IT guru, without whom these sessions would not occur. And third, of course, Teresa, for taking care of all the registrations and the troubleshooting. And finally, of course, Elizabeth, for taking the time, even though she is on the road, to actually find a Starbucks, get herself hopefully a good coffee, and to get ready to do the session. So Elizabeth, it's your show.
Great. Thank you so much, Ed. Actually, I had no time to get a coffee, so we'll see.
Oh,
how we
no.
Do
right. Well, look, in that case, Elizabeth, if you want to get a coffee, I've got to go through the troubleshooting slides for folks. So do that, and I'll do these in about 2 minutes or
okay,
even less.
Great.
The first slide you're going to see up there is a slide that takes you to the control panel. And basically, this slide is there because we want you to know that questions are really welcomed during this session. Okay? So if you've got a question, you go to the control panel, you click on the questions box, and it'll pop up. Then you type it in, exactly what you see it's typed in now, and then you press send, and you'll see I'm drawing a send there for you. And whack, boom, it will be here, and I will see it. And I'll make sure that we cover that question. The next slide that I want to show you is also involving the control panel. And that's for people who decide that they don't want to use the mic and speakers on their computer because that's the default, but that they'd rather call in and listen on the telephone. If that was the case, you would also go to the control panel. You would click on the audio box, and then you'll see that you've got either use telephone or use mic and speakers. If you want to use the telephone, you would circle, see with that there, click on that button, and up would pop a dial-in number, an access code, and an audio pin. Not this one, okay? It's not going to be this one because you know, I'm giving you the little dot here, you know and I know that this is just for the sake of presentation. You would get one just for this call. And then you would dial in, and voila, you would be on the line. Now, Elizabeth, it's your turn to go. And maybe Elizabeth is getting
great.
A coffee.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us today. It's been really a pleasure to be able to talk to you about economic empowerment and financial stability. And I'd like to echo the thanks and compliments to Michelle for doing two sessions on financial literacy. So hopefully all of you got to experience that. Today we're going to talk about some of the more detailed opportunities that exist within this framework. We're going to talk about volunteer income tax assistance, the earned income tax credit, and the ability for people to request split refunds, individual development accounts, and we're going to talk about how all of you as WIN members can use these three tools to help empower people to increase their economic empowerment. We're also going to talk about how these tools impact a person's public benefits. So you're going to be equipped with a lot of information today, and we made sure we gave you all of the links to the regulations so that as you move forward and people have questions, you know where to go for more detailed information. Let's just do a quick review on economic empowerment, what it is and why it's important. As you likely recall from the first webinar, it's a series of strategies that we believe really has the potential to help people improve their economic stability. By doing that, people will have decreased stress, and financial crisis in an individual's life will not be so redundant and have such a strong impact. It also really expands opportunities for community participation. You know, if you don't have the dollars to leave the house, it's pretty hard to participate in community life, and therefore positively impact an individual's quality of life overall. The premise of our work is that the presence of a disability and the need to maintain a public benefit should not require one to forfeit their economic stability and live in poverty. And we really accepted poverty and disability going hand in hand for far too long. So we want to empower folks to have the knowledge and the guidance that they need so that they can earn about these issues, learn about financial stability, and get the financial literacy that they need, start saving money, sometimes in traditional savings accounts, other times in protected accounts, and build the assets and the financial future that they'd like for themselves. Let's go to the next slide, Ray. So we're going to go over some of the strategies, which are on the next slide. And there's a lot of them, as you're going to see. So as you may recall from the first webinar, we tried to bundle these into things that made sense and went together, such as financial literacy, budgeting, and credit repair, use of work incentives along with use of tax incentives, like the volunteer income tax assistance and the earned income tax credit, Medicaid for working people as its own separate tool, and we really want to encourage you to be thinking about those that you serve and give them a heads up as to when they should be looking at enrolling in Medicaid for working people. All of these different opportunities exist in many of the areas throughout New York, family self-sufficiency programs, individual development accounts, assistive technology loan funds, student loans, of course, and retirement accounts. We also want to talk to folks. We wouldn't normally think of it as like a financial stability or economic empowerment tool, but these are the kinds of things we want people to lean towards so that they can increase their earnings and increase their potential towards financial stability. And that's post-secondary education, employment, self-employment, microenterprise, and home ownership. And of course, along the way, folks are going to run into barriers. There's really no way around that. So we want to always keep in mind services like protection and advocacy. Taxpayer advocates, which may be a new term for many of you on the line, credit counseling, volunteer tax assistance, all of you as WIN members, and of course, local WIPA. So today we're going to focus on just three of these tools. As I mentioned, the volunteer income tax assistance, earned income tax credit, and individual development accounts. And if you're looking at all of the other strategies and thinking, well, I want to know about some of these other strategies as well, of course, support is available to you. You can let myself know or shoot an email to Ed and Ray, the folks you usually talk to, and together we'll work to get you the information that you need. So let's start off with volunteer income tax assistance. You know, sometimes we look at volunteer income tax assistance as a first step towards folks becoming economically empowered, and I would almost argue that financial literacy is probably a better first step, but we are starting to head into tax time, and every year this provides a really unique opportunity for folks to think about getting their taxes done, securing their earned income tax credit, and being thoughtful about what they're going to do with those dollars. So we want to make sure you know about this resource in your local community. The IRS works with volunteer income tax assistance sites, they're typically called VITA sites, to help people prepare their tax returns and claim the earned income tax credit for free. So volunteers typically run the sites, and they are trained by the IRS to particularly look for tax credits such as the earned income tax credit and the child care tax credit. And in 2009, VITA sites saved taxpayers with disabilities $36.2 million alone. And how they come to that figure is this means that folks did not have to go to paid tax preparers such as H&R Block or Jackson Hewitt, all of the folks that, quite honestly, I try to not think about because I only want to tell people to come to VITA sites. So it's a tremendous saving. And as Ed said, wow, let's go to the next slide. So this is a great chance for people to file for free. And the reason why we want to make sure folks within the disability community understand this is because we have done a really good job of advising people that they have no tax liability. So typically, in inordinately large numbers, individuals with disabilities who are working part-time or have minimal employment throughout the year do not file their taxes. And they miss out on huge tax credits, as we're going to talk about in another few slides. So I want to encourage you to encourage everybody that you're serving, if they're earning $49,000 and below, to go and have their taxes prepared for free. VITA sites are located all throughout the community. And there's even an opportunity for disability organizations to work with the local tax coalition to have a VITA site set up at their own location. And if you're interested in doing something like that, now is actually the time to do it. Now is when the sites are being set up and the volunteers are being trained. So it's a great opportunity to make sure that those you serve are going to get the services that they need in a location that they're comfortable with. So we put the numbers on there for you, how you can locate a VITA site. It's 211 throughout much of New York and 311 in the New York City area. And sorry to make you go back. There's also a toll-free number that you can call from anywhere, 800-829-1040. And that is the IRS's toll-free number specifically to help people locate a VITA site. Okay, now we can go to the next slide. So the key to working with VITA sites is helping people secure this credit, the earned income tax credit. And it's a credit specifically designed for people who earn low to moderate income. It reduces the individual's taxes and means a refund. So even individuals who have no tax liability can get money back from the IRS because of this earned income tax credit. So let me show you how on the next slide.
Actually, let's go one more. So here's the preview of the 2010 tax year. And as you can see, it gives you all of the gross income amounts and whether or not you need one or more qualifying children. So it lets you know that if a person has three or more qualifying children and their income is below $43,352, they could be eligible for, and you go down to this tax year maximum credit, up to $5,666. So that's a huge credit that an individual could receive back from the federal government. Even if you go to the lowest income that we're looking at, if a person earns less than $13,460 with no qualifying children, they could receive $457 back from the IRS. It's really important that we as a community start to encourage individuals with disabilities to secure these dollars, because the IRS estimates that the disability community alone leaves millions of dollars on the table each year by not claiming their earned income tax credit. The only way you can get the earned income tax credit is by filing your taxes. So it's critically important that we advise people to, at no cost, utilize the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, file their taxes for free, and check to see if they're eligible for the earned income tax credit.
Absolutely. And Elizabeth, if I could just jump in for a minute, I always stress to my SSI clients especially that it is extremely important for them, if they are working, to file their income tax, because they always complain to me about the fact that when SSI does their, you know, calculation, it's always based on gross income. So I always explain to them that should they file income tax returns at the end of the year, they're going to get a refund. Everything they paid in, given their income level, is going to be given back to them. But not only that, because of the earned income tax credit, while they often complain to me that they can't get back their FICA, this makes up for most of the FICA withdrawn from their paychecks. So it's a phenomenal way of getting the money back.
It really is. Thanks, Ed. And, you know, if folks on the line, if you look at this by way of what we typically tell folks to do, a lot of times folks are encouraged not to earn. Well, I know that all of you don't do this, but other practitioners who maybe don't understand the rules as well typically encourage folks to earn under the SGA, which we know is $1,000. So we're talking about folks who are earning maybe $12,000. Well, the earned income amount for 2010, the lowest amount is $13,460. So we have actually, for years now, been creating a group of people who qualify for the earned income tax credit. And some of the myths that prevent people from filing is the idea that they don't have to file, that they have to be married, and that they have to have children. And as you can see, those things are not true. As long as you file, you do not have to be married, and you do not have to have children, but you must file in order to qualify.
Right, and the fact, Elizabeth, one person just wrote in and said, so let me get this straight. You are recommending that all persons with disabilities who work file income tax returns, right?
Yes.
And that's exactly what we're recommending. Absolutely true. I have a second person who just wrote, sent in a question that said, are you going to get a chance to tell us what the determinant for qualifying child or children are, or is this for a different training session?
It's a great question. Actually, it gets very detailed, so we put it on the bottom of this slide. There's a little asterisk that says for more information on whether a child qualifies, and it gives you the link.
Right, and just so people know, Ray Sabula and I just did an earned income tax credit hour and a half session. I did the entire earned income tax credit session, and it's going to be archived, and people can actually go to our website in about 2 weeks and pull it up.
Great.
Elizabeth, want me to go to the next slide or go one back?
Let's go to the next slide.
Great.
Okay, so here are some other requirements for the earned income tax credit. Of course, having a valid Social Security number. The person has to have earned income, so it needs to be from employment or from self-employment. Your filing status cannot be married filing separately. The individual must be a U.S. citizen or a resident alien or a non-resident alien married to a U.S. citizen or resident alien and filing a joint return. You cannot be a qualifying child of another person. And this is an area where we have seen a little bit of misunderstanding within the disability community. But in every local area, there's an IRS SEC person who is available to handle complicated questions at the tax site. And if you do not have a qualifying child, you must be age 25 but under age 65, live in the U.S. more than half a year, and not qualify as a dependent of another person. And, of course, the last one, you cannot file Form 2555 related to foreign earned income. I have to tell all of you on the line, it's been really interesting working with the IRS because they have a language all of their own. So just when you've gotten comfortable with Social Security's language, you move over to the IRS and it's all new language all over again. So as you move into this this field of vision, I would like to say, don't worry if things start to get confusing. There are wonderful partners at the IRS who have specifically made an effort to connect with the disability community. They're called IRS SEC, and there's one in every local area is covered by an IRS SEC person. Your folks in New York are wonderful, and they're led by Richard Keeling, who has made himself very available to help with technical questions and to provide additional support for targeted webinars on specific issues related to disability. So just moving on, some of the benefits of EITC are that the individual can use these dollars to think about how they might want to build assets or improve their credit, do something along the lines of adding to their own financial stability. So for an example, you could look at your earned income tax credit as found dollars and spend it foolishly, but as we learned from Shay, we want to be very thoughtful about found dollars. So it's a great time to encourage folks to open a checking account. If they've had bad problems in the past with checking, they could look at opening a savings account. Opening a savings account as a bank, it does not have the same rules as opening a checking account, and it's a great way for a person to start to establish trust with a local financial institution. People could also use the dollars to pay down major debt or to work with a credit counseling organization to decide how best to start paying down their debt. And the IRS now offers a chance for folks to split their refund. So at the VITA site, they can split their refund into up to three different accounts. So individuals could look at putting part of it into their a general account, say for their bills, maybe set aside a smaller amount to start saving. They could purchase savings bonds at the VITA site. They've been increasingly looking at ways to make sure that folks have immediate opportunities to make good choices with their earned income tax credit money, because the individuals who are receiving these dollars are from low to moderate incomes and often have a multitude of challenges facing them and have to make some tough decisions about what to do with those dollars.
Absolutely. I have a question for you, Elizabeth, from someone. Someone just wrote and said, could you please let us know what you mean by IRS SPEC? What does SPEC stand for?
Sure. It's, stakeholders, partnerships, education, and communication.
Beautiful. Thanks. I'm sorry to interrupt you there.
No, that's okay. It's a division of the IRS that goes out to work within the community to help make sure that employers understand what to do around taxes, and now that individuals understand what to do to claim their earned income tax credits, to build really wonderful VITA sites and to make sure that folks from low to moderate incomes are getting all of the IRS dollars that are due them.
Absolutely. And Elizabeth, we have a question that's right on point that that brings us to the heart of the issue. Sharon says, or Martin Birnbaum says, I work with some individuals that do not get SSA benefits. Would they still be eligible for an earned income tax credit if they're within the proper guidelines and they are working? And the answer is a resounding yes.
A resounding yes. Yeah,
yes.
Go back to that slide on eligibility. It shows you that benefits has nothing to do with it. Oh, one more, two more down, Ed. There you go.
Absolutely. It's not just a program for people with disabilities. It is a program for everyone.
Absolutely. And if we go, if you look back at the chart when you have time offline, you might find that yourself or your family would qualify. There's plenty of folks in my family that qualify, and every year I encourage them go to the local VITA site. Some just prefer to do it themselves, but it's a wonderful opportunity for anybody who qualifies. It's not just low income, it's low to moderate income, and it's a wonderful way to make sure that folks are getting the dollars that are due them back. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, so I know that many of you are have heard from individuals that they don't file their taxes because they are afraid that their tax refund will count against them. And it's a very good concern, but there's some very specific language around this for folks that receive SSI. An earned income tax payment does not count as income, and it does not count as a resource. So I pulled up the POMS for you and gave it to you on this slide, but you should know that folks who receive SSI do not have to be concerned. Regardless of the tax year, their earned income tax payments are not going to count as income. And an individual actually receives 9 months to determine what they're going to do with their refund before it counts as a resource. So that's 9 months that I would say, you know, we probably want to not bank on people waiting 9 months to decide what to do, but folks do have quite a bit of time to figure out what they're going to do with their earned income tax credit refund, whether or not they'd like to use it solely to pay down debt, or whether they'd like to consider putting a portion of it into a savings account or into an asset building program like the IDAs that we're going to talk about soon.
Absolutely. And Elizabeth, worst comes to worst, they can always call 1-800-ED-LOPEZ, and he can tell them exactly how they can spend the money fast. I'm very good at that. Okay. Very good at
that.
Is that
really his number, Ed?
No, I'm just joking. That was one of my yuck-yuckers. Hey, listen, I've got another question that's right on point here. Person writes in and says, many people with disabilities have a big fear of banking institutions, and they would rather just go to the check cashing places and cash their checks. They don't want to go into tax preparers, nothing. Do you have any ideas about how to help people overcome this fear?
I think, you know, probably all of you as peers might have wonderful ideas of what has worked amongst you. We have some programs going on in 8 communities now that are helping us to look at what some of the barriers are that folks are facing and why they're choosing not to bank. Many individuals report that they don't bank because they had a bad experience with a bank. I encourage folks to use credit unions. They have a much softer touch, and their credit unions were established specifically to support low-income and communities like immigrant communities that were disenfranchised from the local banking institution. So my recommendation is to talk to folks about utilizing a credit union and to support them in, even if they choose not to bank, to participate in a financial literacy program, and the information they'll receive on why they should be banked through those programs could hopefully help to change their mind about those misconceptions with banking.
Absolutely.
Ed, you're and really experienced. Do you have any thoughts?
No. Listen, I think you've just covered most of them. And so much of it is financial literacy education. And so I think you're right, Elizabeth. If people are told, you know, and helped to go into a place like with the VITA or a place that does IDAs, that talks about financial literacy, that they become more accustomed and more comfortable then with it. It's just this fear, because unfortunately in the ghetto, in the slum sometimes, that's they're worried that if they put money in the bank, someone else is going to seize it. And they've heard stories about that. So it's a concern. And Elizabeth, I wanted to respond to three questions that came up all at the same time. Three people said, wait a minute, is it really true that the earned income tax credit refund or payment is excluded from resources for 9 calendar months? I thought the rule was income in the month received and the month after. It's a resource, and that's the general rule, folks. But for earned income tax credit, there is a special rule, and it's excluded as a resource from counting as a resource for the 9 calendar months following the month the refund or payment is received, just as it states on slide 16. Just so you know.
Yep, and the POMS is right there, you guys. So, you know, of course. I'm somebody myself who I like to see it in black and white so I can fully understand it. So I really encourage you to pull that up and have it printed out so that you can show folks in black and white, this is what Social Security says about this.
Absolutely. And we're going to go on to the next slide for you.
Great. Now, here's where we get into a little bit of different rules. It's state Medicaid and the earned income tax credit. So. The state Medicaid rules are not exactly the same. The earned income tax credit is disregarded as income. It will not count against the person as income. And it will not count as a resource, but as the previous question asked, it won't count as a resource for the month received and the following month. So we're thrilled that all of you as WIN members are the ones participating on these calls, because we know that folks don't always know which kind of, where they're getting their Medicaid from. And it's important to keep this in mind that we can't categorically say about Medicaid, but we can say for SSI, it will not count as a resource for 9 months. But for state Medicaid, it's only excluded in the month received and the following month. Then it will count as a resource. And the directives are there so that you can take a closer look if you choose to. For food stamps, the federal earned income tax credit, and they also always say advance payments. Some people choose to get it as advance payments, but it's always treated the same. For food stamps, they're not included as income. And as a resource, they're also not included as a resource. But food stamps says that they want to know that the funds are identifiable. So that's a little bit different language. They want to make sure that folks know that that they should keep their earned income tax credit refund in a way that's identifiable.
So right, and it's akin to a PASS account, a separate PASS account, basically. So that they want to know that this program is segregated, it's there for a reason, and that it's not going to be, quote, commingled with other resources.
Exactly. Thanks, Ed. So that may be an area where you have folks ask questions about, and I would say it's a great opportunity if folks don't have a savings account to open a savings account and put these dollars in. That way they certainly would remain identifiable in that separate savings account. And there's, again, the link there so that you can learn more as questions come up about food stamps. Okay, let's go to the next one. Okay, HUD programs and the earned income tax credit. I don't know about you guys, but I always get a little bit frustrated in some of these federal programs, because it would be so nice if if all the programs treated it the same. But unfortunately, they don't do that. So we're making sure you get all of the major ones. HUD programs, the earned income tax refund will not include, be counted as income, so that's very good news for HUD programs. And it also will not be counted as a resource. However, if the individual earns interest on the payment, then that interest would count as income. So I actually would say if you have questions about that, I would type them in now quickly so that we can cover them. Or, of course, you can always wait till the end. But that's the language that they have. It will not count as a resource. It's just that if you have it in an interest-bearing account, then the interest will count as income.
That's right. And, Elizabeth, we have a comment here. And it's from Fran Wishnick. And Fran says, and Fran is one of our best Medicaid benefits practitioners out there. She says that she has different information on state Medicaid and the earned income tax credit from self-help, which of course is the legal services website program. And she says that it says that the earned income tax credit is exempt in the month received and in the month following for all Medicaid categories, but they have an exception, except disabled adults and the age 65 plus, where it is disregarded for all 9 months.
Oh,
and it's in the,
Thanks,
it's on page 322 of the MARG, which is the Medicaid Reference Guide. So Fran, thank you.
Thanks, Fran. That's
okay.
Much better.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, we'll change that slide for next time. We really appreciate that, Fran. Thank you.
That's wonderful.
Okay, we're up to temporary assistance and EITC.
Okay, so temporary assistance, it will not count the earned income tax credit as a resource or as income. So that's very good news. Good job, State of New York, with temporary assistance. And we'll go to the next one. Okay, so now we're going to talk about individual development accounts. Individual development accounts are a great way for folks to set aside money, kind of like a PAF plan. It goes into a protected account. So it's an asset building strategy that has been gaining a lot of popularity. They're fairly new. They just started receiving federal funding in the late 90s. And currently there's two federal funding sources, Temporary Aid to Needy Families, or TANF, and Assets for Independence Act, which comes under Health and Human Services at the federal level.
That's right. And for those of you who are who know that, TANF is now called in New York Family Assistance. Okay, so, but it's the same sources. Family Assistance is part of that Temporary Aid to Needy Families umbrella from the federal government.
So the idea of what an individual development account is it's a match savings account, and they're specifically designed for individuals with limited income and limited wealth to save money and to build assets. So an IDA is started by a partner in the local community. They'll work with a financial institution. They'll seek out funding from private donors, foundations, state and local governments, folks who will put up the match money. There's a non-federal match to these programs. And they'll typically match the savings of the individual account holder at a rate ranging from $1 to $8 for each dollar saved. So I gave you a quick example. If the IDA program has a 2-to-1 match, then the IDA program would be providing $2,000 to a person who saved $1,000 in their account. So this is an opportunity for folks to get a jump start towards an asset of their choosing, and we're going to cover their choices on the next slide.
That's right. And Elizabeth, I just want to add, let people know that last year, during the big first time home owner tax credit period in Ithaca, there was actually an IDA account that gave an 8-for-1 match. So people use that to get $8,000 that they used to buy a home, and then they got the tax credit for being first-time homeowners too. So they leveraged one for the other, which is spectacular. So this is an incredibly valuable program.
That's great. And I also want to add to all of you on the line, you know, you don't have to have a disability to participate in an IDA program. So as we're reading these, just keep in mind, I know we're talking about those that you serve, but we could be talking about some of you on the line as well. So an IDA can be used to purchase a home, higher education, training, or business capital. And one of the wonderful things about individual development accounts is that the IDA programs require financial education classes. So a person who is interested in opening an IDA account does not have to be ready to purchase an asset. The program is designed to build a person and their savings to the point where they can participate in purchasing a home or higher education and training or business capital. So the IDA provider will set up financial education classes. They'll also connect people to credit counseling, to VITA services. They'll make sure that they're claiming their earned income tax credit. And many programs even look to see, do you qualify for a public benefit that could help you save money in the short term while you're trying to continue to build yourself and your financial stability. So the only, you know, caveat that you have to think of with individual development accounts is that these are the three things that can be purchased: a home, higher education and training, or business capital. Many times folks want to know if their IDA can be used to purchase a vehicle. And there are, in some communities, IDA programs that do provide that. But federally funded IDA programs look to these three purchases: home, higher education and training, or business capital.
Absolutely. And we have a question from my friend Elaine Cost, who says, is there a list of financial institutions that we could readily access so that we know who is offering IDAs in our communities?
Yeah, so let's go to the next slide. How about one more, and we'll come back to this.
Great.
One more.
There we are.
And one more. Oh,
yeah, that's
okay. You know what, Elaine? I think it's at the end of all the slides. So
okay.
I did put.
So we'll get to it later.
For you, we will. But it's a great question, and it's one of the most popular questions folks have when it comes to IDA programs. Because of course, a program's great as long as you can locate it. So we will get back to that towards the end of the slide. So here's some of the IDA program eligibility. Probably the most important one for us to think about is this first one. You must have earned income. So for many of the folks that we're working with, this is really key to be thinking about. You have to have earned income. It's not a program for folks who are receiving a public benefit and want to put, say, their SSDI into the program. That doesn't work. The program requires that you have earned income. And many IDA providers are very thoughtful about letting people know that it's any earned income. So they may work with the individual to say, okay, well, you're running a small babysitting business. Let's talk about how we get that on the books as, you know, earned income. So it doesn't always have to be traditional employment, but it does have to be earned income. Here are the other income guidelines. For folks who want to work with a TANF IDA, they have to be eligible at the time of application. It's interesting language, right? You have to be eligible. It doesn't say you have to be receiving, but you have to be eligible. Or you have to have adjusted gross household income equal to or less than 200% of the federal poverty level, and household net worth less than $10,000. And as you're used to, of course, they're excluding the primary dwelling, the home that the person lives in, and one vehicle. Or, here's the shortcut, be eligible for the federal earned income tax credit. So you can see how these three programs start to build on each other. We want people to go file their taxes for free, right? No cost, low risk, Go file your taxes for free at a Vitasite. Let them check to see if you are eligible for the earned income tax credit. So if they'll do the work for you, they'll check to see if you're eligible. If you are, you're going to get money back in your pocket, and you're going to know that you're eligible to participate in an IDA program. So it's great to know that if the person received federal earned income tax credit, then they're automatically eligible for IDA program as long as they also have earned income.
Right. And Elizabeth, what? No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I'll ask you the question and finish your sentence. Okay.
No,
well, we have a couple of people just wrote in this question at the same time, which is very funny. It's the same question. They basically say, if your earned income tax credit is not fully used, okay, does it carry forward, or what happens to it? And so I think what they're trying to ask, Elizabeth, without asking them, is SSI-wise, if they don't spend it in 9 months, it's then going to be considered a resource and counted towards that $2,000 resource amount. If they're not SSI folk and they're not on public assistance, they don't have to worry about it. They don't have to spend it. They can save it.
Yeah, and let me carry that question one step further, just so that we cover all our bases. Some of you may be thinking about doing your own taxes and you say get a deduction. The earned income tax credit is not a deduction, it's a credit. So if at the end of your paperwork you owe, say, $200, it's not that it brings you to zero, it's that it brings you all the way down into, and I'm probably, whoever is IRS on the call is probably like, oh, Elizabeth, please don't say it like that. So let me not say it like that. It's not a deduction. You're not trying to get to zero. It's a credit. So even if you don't owe money, you're going to get this refund back in your pocket.
Absolutely. And it's something that, in fact, it's one of the most popular questions asked. People will say, if I owe $200 and I'm supposed to get a $400 credit, what happens? The answer is, if you owe $200 on your taxes, when you do your taxes, and you've got that $400 credit, basically you wind up getting $200 as an earned income tax credit because of the first $100 is used to offset what you owe. That's how it works. Okay? And I have a phenomenal question here about IDAs as you get started. It says, are IDAs always geographically limited? Because suppose we don't have one in our county. Can we access an existing IDA in a different county, an adjoining county?
That's a great question. And the answer is, it depends on how that program set up their IDA. So most programs are geographically limited. They put the limitations on themselves. So you'd have to check with the program to see which area they're serving. They could be serving more than one county. It'll just depend on how they set up their program. And it really sets us right into this, the program variation. There are a lot of variations program to program. The federal AFI program allows folks to set up their program in a way that they can choose a target population, they can choose program requirements, minimum investment, and what that means is some say we'll match you once you hit $1,000. Some say we'll match you once you hit $500. It just depends on the program. They also decide how much money they want people to save each month. So many programs set a goal of $25 a month, but they could set it at any amount. They could set it at $50. It's really up to the program. They also determine a length of required savings. And the savings goal, as you all know now, it's for to purchase a home, education or training, or business capital. They can limit that. So a program could have an IDA program, and they could decide, we only do home ownership, or we only do self-employment. It's up to the program to decide. You know, one of the really important things to think about when they talk about the minimum or maximum amount saved each month and the length of required savings, these programs have been set up to be more than just, let's get you to this asset. They're very thoughtfully set up to build a person's financial literacy and to create a learned savings behavior. So they're training the individual to be thoughtful about their budgeting, just like we learned from Mache, and to pay themselves first, to make sure that they're setting aside the amount that they need to set aside each month for a required period of time so that folks create a habit of savings.
That's right. And in fact, Elizabeth, a lot of the IDAs, as you mentioned before, have requirements that people participate in financial literacy classes.
Yes, it's very thoughtful. So the individual, again, does not have to be ready to purchase. You know, don't look at an individual and say, well, I know from talking to them, they're not ready for homeownership. They don't need to be ready. They need to have a goal. And it's the IDA provider, and many of them are extremely talented in this. There's a wonderful program that we highlighted at the MIG Employment Summit in Buffalo, the Belmont Shelter Resources of Western New York. The individual they brought with them, she is not homeownership ready, but she has a goal to be a homeowner. So she's been attending financial literacy classes. She and her husband have moved from a group home supported setting into their own apartment so that they can build a rental history. And from that, they'll start the movement towards opening their IDA account and beginning to participate towards saving a home. So the IDA program administrator recognizes this person is not homeownership ready, but they have a goal. They have a dream of building this asset, and that's what the IDA program is there for. It's there to assist people to build their financial literacy and to build their assets towards purchasing that dream. One thing that's important to recognize is that folks should know whether or not the IDA program is federally funded through TANF or AFIA. And the reason why they need to know that is because the benefit rules are set up differently. They are much more lenient towards TANF and AFI-funded IDA programs. So it's an important caveat when somebody is going to participate in a local IDA program that you know whether or not it's funded through TANF or AFI, which is Assets for Independence. Okay. Thanks, Ed. So let's start talking about the impact on public benefits. So the federal rules say that assets accrued in an IDA established under TANF or AFIA money cannot, under federal regulations, negatively impact an individual's eligibility for federal programs. So by that, they mean the individual's contributions, the matching contributions, and the interest cannot be considered as an asset when determining eligibility or benefit levels. So that's really wonderful news for those that we serve that receive public benefits. It's very cut and dry. If it's a TANF or AFIA-funded IDA, then it cannot be considered an asset. And that's all of the money, the individual's contribution, the matching contribution. Remember, Ed said there was one program that was 8-to-1. That matching contribution under an AFIA or TANF IDA cannot be counted against the individual. And I gave you the code so that you can look it up if you choose to, or sometimes set a person's mind at ease if they'd like to see it themselves. Okay, let's get into the ones that are a little bit more specific. So here's SSI and qualified IDAs. SSI has a whole spotlight on IDAs so that folks can feel confident participating. As you likely understand from the previous slide, SSI will not count the person's contributions or matching contributions against them. And then SSI has an added benefit of deducting the individual's contribution from their countable earned income. So we're going to give you an example of that on the next slide. Here we go. Here's the calculation that you guys are all so familiar with. Of course, we had to make it look a little different so it would fit on the slide. But here's an individual who's earning $900 a month, has no other income, and is not participating in an IDA program. So we went down through the calculation sheet. At the bottom, you see an SSI amount of $353.50. Let's go to the next one and see what happens when they do participate. As you can see, the IDA contribution is deducted from the gross monthly earnings. So the individual ends up with more money in their SSI check, and they have money set aside to save in their federally funded IDA accounts. It's a wonderful opportunity for folks to save, just like a PASS plan. But as many of you know, probably when you talk to folks about PASS plans, people always want to know, can I use my PASS account to save for home ownership? And what do you always have to say? No, you cannot. So an IDA program is really complementing PASS because it does allow a person to save for home ownership. And for folks who have other work goals that they're using a PASS plan for, if their work goal includes business capital or education, then the IDA would be very complementary because it would provide additional funding for them to achieve their goal. And a person can do both. They can have a PASS plan and an IDA at the same time. And Ed, this seems like a great time for you to add something.
No, let me tell you, you're doing a phenomenal job of getting all that information in there. The only thing I will remind people about is that, remember, for a PASS, what we're always looking for is a feasible occupational goal. In fact, I got a call today. I was on the Work Incentives Learning Community call with, you know them, Brian Donahue and Scott Ebner, Elizabeth. And Brian had a client who wanted to have a PASS. And she said she wanted the PASS for one very specific reason, to get a special degree. And I said to him, it can't just be for that. The degree is the means to the end, but there must be a specific work goal in order for the PASS to be approved, or it will not be approved. So he said, I'll have to go back and talk to her about it because she wants to get a degree. Well, an IDA would be very good for that because it would be good for education in some areas. It would be good for business capital. It doesn't just have to be to reach a specific work goal. So, but you're doing a great job, Elizabeth. I'm learning a lot.
And so here are some other examples of how they all correlate. So as Ed was mentioning, you know, a PASS plan and an IDA can end up complementing each other. So say the IDA funds are used for post-secondary education, but IDA funds under that, under post-secondary education, can't pay for room and board. So a person could look at complementing their PASS plan to assist with those costs. Or vice versa, a person could have a non-TANF or IDA, I'm sorry, a non-TANF or AFI-funded IDA, and they could secure those dollars under a PASS plan. So the two can work complementing each other back and forth. And we know that you're not going to have enough from this one webinar to fully feel comfortable executing something like that. But just remember, technical assistance is always available to you. So it's just knowing what's possible, and then we'll walk you through how to get it done. Also, other complementary work incentives are property essential to self-support. So the IDA funds that purchase the business capital would then be excluded as a resource under PESS. And IRWIs and blind work expenses, as individuals increase their financial literacy, remember that's a part of work of building towards an IDA, folks will participate in financial literacy and budgeting. And they may find that in doing their budgeting, as Michelle mentioned, one of the first things folks should be encouraged to do is to keep a spending diary, document everything they're spending money on. And when they do that practice, it's a great way to isolate impairment-related work expenses and blind work expenses. Costs an individual may have been spending but hadn't really noticed because, quite frankly, maybe they weren't paying close enough attention to everything they were spending money on. Or they never had it written down and available for somebody to look at and say, isn't that related to your disability? Didn't you pay for that to go to work? Let's count that as an IRWI. Okay, so a lot of wonderful opportunities for you as WIN members to use these strategies to complement the work and the information that you're already providing. It gets a little bit more complicated when it's non-TANF or AFI IDAs and you're looking at an individual's public benefit. Generally, the assets accrued in an IDA established using TANF or IDA money cannot, under federal regulations, negatively impact an individual's eligibility. So if it's a TANF or AFI IDA, you can feel really comfortable. But states decide for themselves how non-TANF and non-AFI IDAs will impact state Medicaid, temporary assistance, and food stamps. So we're going to go through these rather quickly since we're more than halfway through our webinar. So let's take a look at these. That'll be next slide, Ed.
It's a little delay, about a 3-second delay. It should be up now.
Okay, great, thanks. So for individual development accounts, they really look at it as a trust created on behalf of an individual eligible for family assistance and funded through periodic contributions. That's how New York State Medicaid's office is going to look at it. And so they're not going to count it against the individual if it's set up in this way. So if it's an organization who meets the definition of being a nonprofit or a local district acting in cooperation with a nonprofit organization, then they're not going to count the individual development account against the individual. And they have a resource on this under New York State Medicaid rules, and the link is provided to you. So let me just say it one more time because I realized I said it a little messy there. So for New York State Medicaid, the individual's IDA account will not count against them as long as it's set up an account that, like a trust that the individual doesn't have access to, and it's set up by a not-for-profit or a local district acting in cooperation with a not-for-profit. And that resource is available to you in their Medicaid guide on page 307. Okay, temporary assistance and non-TANF and AFI IDAs. So it's going to be disregarded under, under New York State's temporary assistance, it's going to be disregarded in determining a person's eligibility, and that's going to count for them. It's going to actually not count against them for public assistance, food stamps, or medical assistance. So that is really great. Your New York State, compared to some other states, has been very thoughtful about how to handle these accounts. And where you seem to get into some trouble is folks don't like it when the accounts are set up in a way that the person has access to. That's why you're going to find when you encourage a person to participate in an IDA account that the IDA account is going to actually be set up by the program, and that's so that it won't count as a resource against the individual. Okay, how about the next one?
Should be up.
Okay, food stamps again. Is not going to count against the individual unless the money is withdrawn for a purpose other than what was listed, and then the remaining balance would be considered an available resource. So it's just a little bit of a difference in language. They, too, talk a lot about business capital, post-secondary education, and home purchase. So it's important when you're working with an individual and they're going to save for something like a vehicle. Like some of the IDA programs have opportunities to save for a vehicle, that we want to look back at the rules and just be thoughtful about how they're going to look at it.
That's right. And I have a great question here for you. Again, Fran Wishnick has a question. She says, she's a bit confused. Can there be a non-TANF or AFA IDA without a matching contribution, or does an IDA have to have a matching contribution and come from TANF or AFA?
That's a great question, Fran, but I have to say I don't know the answer to that because I've never seen an IDA program that didn't have a matching contribution.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I've never seen one. So I'm assuming that they have to have a matching contribution, and in order for the monies in the accounts to be excluded, that they would have to be one of those, either TANF or AFI, I mean.
I'm actually making a note of that question, Fran, and I'm going to look into it.
Great. Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Okay. Let's go on to the next one. Okay. Here are the resources for you. So you can, there's two really good directories. The top one is lists all of the Assets for Independence Act IDA programs, and you can sort by state. And the bottom one is CFED, Corporation for Enterprise Development. They also provide a directory of IDAs. These are IDA programs that may or may not receive TANF or AFI funding. So you you want to be thoughtful about that. But both are very good directories. Of course, I would encourage you to look at the AFI one first to see if you can find a program that's federally disregarded so that you don't have to have any concern. But CFED is a nice one for folks who are looking to save for an opportunity other than homeownership, business capital, or education.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your role in regards to these three opportunities. And we broke it down into three key things: your role as a trailblazer, your role as a resource, and your role as a community partner. So as a trailblazer, and we talked about this a little bit in the first webinar, we really want to encourage you to make the paradigm shift, to acknowledge that public benefits in exchange for poverty is a really bad deal. It's a bad deal for everyone. And that we need to look at part of our work as being the opportunity to encourage people to build their financial life so that they really have equal opportunity and full participation, and that moving from poverty to financial self-sufficiency is the only way that folks are going to have that full participation. We also want you to reconsider the goal of work. So think about yourself. How do you go about seeking employment? Do you consider your talents and abilities, your budget, the cost of going to work, the benefits offered? Typically, all of these play a role in what kind of job you're seeking and what kind of salary you're seeking. And then on the next slide, I wonder if we're making the same considerations for those we serve. For a long time, we've gotten a little bit stuck in allowing short-term needs to dominate the process. The need to stay under SGA, transportation needs, the need to take an immediate job opportunity. And what I mean by this is not to be critical of any of you on the line, but it's really being critical of our system. Our funding provides funding to our agencies based upon how quickly we get somebody employed. So we're always trying to get to that next placement. And we want to consider, is our job really done when we do that? Is our job really done, or did we fulfill a short-term need of that person? And is there more work we can do to help them fulfill their long-term needs? That's what economic empowerment is really challenging us to do, to take a longer term and a broader view at an individual's financial needs so we can be thoughtful about helping them make long-term plans and long-term employment decisions that will, yes, potentially decrease their reliance on public benefits, but as they do that, increase their financial stability and increase their opportunity to live outside of poverty. So we know that it's important for you to be a resource. As you build the group of people that you serve, we know you're looked to as like the first person, the first point of contact, the go-to person, I'm sure, in many communities. So we want to make sure that you understand the potential of economic empowerment, that you understand the different strategies, and that you know where they are locally so you can be a resource to those you serve. Folks with disabilities are actually unbanked at very high rates. So we think that that's a great first step for folks to increase their financial literacy, to get banked, to use a VitaSite, get their taxes done, secure their earned income tax credit, and if they're ready, when they're ready, participate in an IDA program. In addition to folks living outside of poverty, we know that they are going to have decreased stress, improved health, greater community participation and choice. Just as a little, I realize I'm getting on a soapbox a little bit here, but
I love soapboxes.
They're so comfortable. As a nation, we are a nation of debtors. And as a nation, not just the disability community, not just those of us on this call, but as a nation, we are financially illiterate. So we're hoping that engaging you in this conversation will get you thinking about the resources available and what you can do to better your financial future, and that you'll get excited about that and you'll want to also show those that you serve. If you have been around anyone or you yourself have ever had a financial crisis and stuck your head in the sand, then you know it does not help anything. And so we really want to empower everybody that touches this community and is a part of this community to have the information you need to make informed choices. We all have fears around this. Most of us don't want to talk about our finances with anyone else because most likely all of us feel, except maybe Michelle, all of us feel our financial lives are imperfect. But you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to have all the answers. We just want to make sure you're just having the conversation with folks and you're helping them to connect to the strategies and you're helping them to have the documents that they'll need so that when they do let one of their public benefit administrators know what they're doing, they're prepared for that public administrator, public benefit worker to not know what they're doing, to not understand the rules, and to have some resources to share with them. Okay, and then your role as a community partner. If you haven't already, I want to encourage you to join your local Earned Income Tax Credit Coalition. They're called something a little different in every community. Sometimes the Local Tax Coalition, sometimes in several areas of New York, they're called CASH, C-A-S-H, CASH Coalition. And they have been working diligently in many communities throughout New York to provide greater outreach to the disability community. So they're ready and waiting and willing to hear from you. And you have things to offer them. You have a connection to the disability community. So you could help to spread the word about VITA and Earned Income Tax Credit. You could refer folks to the VITA sites during tax time. You could hand out their materials. And you can help them when they have somebody who receives public benefits and isn't quite sure how all of this is going to impact them. So they could actually be a source of referrals back to you. But don't let that discourage you because they really do need your participation to make sure that the disability community fully understands these opportunities are available and can be referred to them. If you're really excited about this work and you're thinking, Elizabeth, I joined my local tax coalition, I'm charged, I'm excited, I want to do more, then you might want to consider facilitating a free financial education training. FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, they are the folks that insure our dollars when we keep them in FDIC-covered banking institutions. They have a really wonderful financial literacy program called Money Smart. And Money Smart is free to everybody. It's available in multiple languages, including Braille. And it's available online or in paper. And they will provide to you free train-the-trainer workshops. So if you can bring together 12 people give them space and set up plans for lunch because they don't want people to leave. They want to do lunch during training. They will bring everything that you need to have a free train-the-trainer workshop. This is a really great opportunity for many of the programs that serve individuals with disabilities. Everybody from school districts who maybe would like to increase the financial literacy to, say, transition age students, to programs for individuals with developmental disabilities that they can gain better financial literacy, clubhouses, so peer-to-peer training. It's really a wonderful opportunity for any entity within this community. And if you're excited and you want to set it up, that's the link, Train the Trainer. And if you have any challenges, you can contact me, and I'll do an introduction to FDIC for you. Okay, let's look at the next one. Here's some resources for you just as you continue on your way down this path into economic empowerment. We've put resources up on New York Makes Work Pay, and that's where you can also tap into many of the webinars that Ed mentioned. Also, the Office of the State Comptroller has created a special site on their website, yourmoneynewyork.org, specifically financial resources for New Yorkers with disabilities. So that's a great link and opportunity. And as you're exploring that, if you see ways to make that better, please let us know, and we'll continue to work with the Office of the State Comptroller to make that a great resource for you. Assets for Independence has a site called idaresources.org. And on idaresources.org, there are boxes for all different special populations, including the disability community. And if you click in there, there's all kinds of resources for you. The partners that work on that are Virginia Commonwealth University, who provide the certified training for the WIPAs, and National Disability Institute, and they provide all of the documents for idaresources.org. It's got some wonderful stuff on there, including how to talk to folks with disabilities about IDAs. There's a checklist on how to make financial literacy accessible. It's a really great resource. If you've never checked it out, it's a public site open to anyone, but designed for IDA providers. And then the organization that I've been...
Elizabeth, I was going to ask you a question. Have you tell that people know that you're working on a newsletter that you're going to be getting to me very soon, and let people know what it's about, because it's something for them to look forward to, because it's about these very issues.
It is. We're going to provide for the newsletter an overview of these tools, specifically folks doing BIDA and Earned Income Tax Credit and participating in IDAs. And every edition of Working Newsletter has had a section on we used to say asset development, but now we're saying economic empowerment. So if you've not had a chance to look back at the Working Newsletters, they're all available on New York Makes Work Pay. And watch for the next one, because it's going to have some more great resources for you.
Great. And they've been excellent. And we've really insisted on making sure that we have in every newsletter a column on assets or economic development. And in fact, at the last meeting, as you know, we all decided that it would be best, in fact, to have one of the three newsletters a year on economic development. And so Elizabeth very kindly and graciously said she would take care of that. And so look forward to one. We get it soon, and we'll have it out by the end of the year. Elizabeth.
And
Elizabeth, you're on time. How about that?
I know. Shocking. Okay, so just a little review of what we learned today. Of course, we talked about economic empowerment and the strategies that are available. The basics of the Earned Income Tax Credit, Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Sites, and Individual Development Accounts. And I just want to remind you that you don't have to remember everything about today, but if you can, as a starting point, start the conversation with folks. If they're working, how are you going to file your taxes this year? Did you know you could file them for free? If they're going to return to work, anytime any of us return to work, we need to take another look at our budget. So how's your budget? Have you ever written a budget? Why don't we talk about some local financial literacy classes? We also went over the impact of these strategies on public benefits and your role in supporting folks, those you serve, and actually even a little bit further, how you can support the local work of the tax coalitions or the cash coalitions, who are really working diligently to make sure that they're getting the word out to the disability community. So they could certainly use your support in that.
Beautiful.
Oh, no,
I just have one final question here from Fran Wishnick, and she prefaces it by saying, sorry if I'm asking a lot of questions, but one last one. Can a creditor go after money in an IDA?
That's a great question. A creditor cannot go after money in an IDA. And actually, an individual, there's some new rules which we could send out to the whole listserv. There are rules around what a creditor can take out of your bank account, and your public benefit cannot be touched, but they now have up to a minimum amount that cannot be touched. So you have to have over that amount in a bank account. And Fran, I think you might be ahead of a lot of folks on some of these issues, so it's been wonderful to have you on the call and have you ask questions. But we'll send out those rules to the listserv so that folks can better understand. One of the barriers to folks getting banked is if they owe money, they're afraid to put their money in a bank account because it'll get snatched by whoever they owe the money to, the creditor. So there are specific rules around how much money a person has to have in their account before it's eligible to be seized by the creditor, and a person's public benefit cannot be taken. So we'll send those rules out so that you can share it with those that you serve. And remember that this is the kind of stuff that the local tax coalitions have been receiving information about and make it their business to know. So they're going to be a great partner for you as you start this conversation with folks. And you have all of my information. And although I can't claim to be a Michael Jordan fan, I really love that quote on the slide before. And it really speaks true to me of all of this work. You have to expect things of yourself before you can do them. We have really created an expectation that if you live on public benefits, you live in poverty. And probably that is going to be our greatest challenge, is to break that and to tell people that they not only can, but they have a right to expect more of their life than just poverty. And we have to make sure people have that expectation before they're going to do it. So if nothing else, if you have that paradigm shift and you start to talk to people about increasing their financial independence, becoming financially stable, participating in these programs that are already available and are designed for low-income workers, I think that's going to be a great first step. So as you move along the path, if you have questions for me, please use my contact information. And, of course, as you can hear from this webinar and the first one and the two in between, Ed and Ray are fully literate in all of this, so they're going to be a wonderful support to you.
Elizabeth, as always, wonderful presentation. You've got Elizabeth's contact information. You've got our contact information. I'll tell you right now that if you send something to us and we're not sure about, I will immediately contact Elizabeth and ask her for feedback also. We will not just not get back to you. So please, by all means, do it. And my friends, I think that is it. It is 11:25. We got done a few minutes early. Thank you, Elizabeth, Michelle, for the wonderful four-part series, ACID webinars, and to Jeff and Teresa for doing all the work they do for us all the time. So, my friends, take care, and we will see you very soon. Adios.